Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer and researcher Jeremy Minot. He's an emeritus fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and was formerly chief executive of Cambridge University Press, and we're continuing our conversation about his new book, The Story of Nature, A Human History. Jeremy, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk about this book.
Well, thank you, Mark, and thank you for giving me an encore.
It's the least I could do. This is unabashedly, this is my favorite book, and I love all your books. This is your best book by far. It's an important book, and I really want more people to read it. Martin Rees, you quote him early. We're going to talk about the last couple of chapters, which is about future nature. Martin Rees goes, it's a dangerous delusion to think that space offers an escape from Earth's problems. You know, everybody, I think, a lot of people have this delusion that somehow we're going to settle on Mars and make it habitable, and that's just BS.
I think it's a complete kind of escapism, really, and an evasion of the problems that we're facing right here and now.
Yeah, you know, and this is one of the things you bring up in the book. We know what we have to do. We know what the problem is. We know what we have to do. We're just not going to do it. And that idea that we know what to do and we know what the problem is, but we're not going to do it or avoid it, just really gives me headaches.
Yep, I think you've summarized it exactly. What I suggest in my book is that there's a serious mismatch between what is evident and scientifically necessary and what is politically possible. And one might add what is personally possible too. It strikes me as rather similar to a situation that a French politician commented on some time back. He wasn't talking about climate change and the environment as such, but I think it applies. He said, he was talking of people in power. He said, we know what we have to do. We just don't know how to get re-elected once we've done it.
That's it. That's it.
It's a kind of free rider problem. We, each of us at an individual level and at a national level, can see what has to be done, but doing it involves short-term sacrifices that we're really not prepared to accept and which governments daren't propose because they wouldn't get elected. And yet it's becoming overwhelmingly evident. I mean, the forces of destruction are sort of rushing at us like a train, aren't
they? Oh, my God. I mean, for the first time I can ever remember, we're having problems with brush fires and drought here in New England. Normally, we're very, very wet at this time of the year. We're now having brush fires. That's definitely a sign of global climate change.
Well, and the hurricanes too, which
oh God, yeah,
you know it. Being suffered in other parts of the world, I ask the question: what would it take, really, to jerk humanity into attention? Would it be New York underwater? You know, what would it be?
And by then, it's too late.
By then, it's too late. That's exactly right. So, I mean, people sometimes ask me, "Am I hopeful?" Well, I say that I am hopeful, but not optimistic. I'm hopeful because if you're not hopeful, you're paralyzed, really, aren't you? You have to behave as if you're a free agent and that you can affect things. But I can't be optimistic.
Well, this reminds me, my brother, who's a physician, a doctor, he lives on the West Coast in San Francisco. And I said, you know, why do you live there? There's going to be eventually a massive earthquake. And he's already been through several serious ones. And, you know, the whole West Coast is eventually going to sink. And he goes, everybody here thinks the same thing. The problem is they think they're going to be able to live their life and not have it. It's going to happen after they die. So they're just blithely living their life going, I'll probably die before we have to really pay any attention to it. And I think that calculus goes into a lot of everyday people's lives. Yeah, there's a problem, we know it, but we're going to die before we have to actually deal with it.
Yeah, I think it's true, but can I just make a distinction? I spend some time in the latter part of the book making a distinction between what you can call the nature crisis and the climate crisis.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there are connections between them, but they're not the same. The nature crisis has been with us for quite some time. And the nature crisis, the lack of biodiversity and abundance in our wildlife, which is now, you know, reaching striking levels. I saw a figure the other day from the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, that in the last 50 years, wildlife numbers have fallen by 73%. I mean, that's just massive. And by the same calculation, thousands of species are threatened with extinction. Well, this didn't actually happen because of climate change. It happened in the UK and in the US and in most other parts of the world as a result of things like intensive agriculture, habitat loss and destruction, pollution, pesticides.
That's absolutely right.
Now, these are all things unconnected with the climate, really. And they are things we can still do something about. When the climate crisis really bites in on nature, it's going to wipe everything out, of course. But one should remember that it's a separate question. And the political imperative to deal with the climate crisis is still with us in the future. But right now, we can do things about the nature crisis.
And you know, as a person who goes out birding constantly, I'm out every week, several times a week. In migration, I was just talking about this with my wife, we're seeing declines in numbers almost across the board in species. And the biodiversity crisis is real, and it's happening now to things that we've thought were common species. And a lot of people don't have long-term memories, I noticed. If you've been birding for a while, like we've been birding for 45 years, you know that things were this way before and they are this way now. But most people just sort of take what's happening now as that's the new bottom line, and we'll compare everything to that. And if people look around the solar system, there's no other biodiversity. This is it. We're not going to suddenly get to another planet in another galaxy somewhere. It's just not going to happen. And I consider biodiversity the most amazing thing about the planet Earth that we had this wealth of species that took amazing forms and shapes and did all sorts of stuff, and we're just losing them left and right. But it's like trying to get people excited about biodiversity seems pointless when everybody's looking at their phone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I absolutely agree with that. And you may remember that I start my final chapter in this book called The Epilogue with an example of a British bird that is almost extinct, the turtle dove. Now, when I was a young person a long while ago, there were turtle doves everywhere. There was one singing in my back garden every summer. They were all around the village. There is a common bird. We've now lost 97% of our turtle
doves. It's amazing.
And we've lost comparable numbers, not quite as bad as that, of such iconic birds as cuckoos, for example. Other countryside birds like corn buntings, they're just falling over a cliff. And it seems to me so crucial, and I try and spell this out when I describe the loss of the turtle dove, that when a naturalist like you or me looks at a bird like a turtle dove, we're not just seeing a pattern of feathers that we are expert enough to identify. We're seeing a whole trail of associations. We're seeing a history. We're seeing a pattern of behavior and how it links with the rest of the environment. We're not just looking at one little item. It's got all these other dimensions of meaning to it. And really what I'm trying to do in this book overall is evoke the sense of meaning that nature can have for us.
You do that really well.
It can have meaning.
Well, you do that very well in that epilogue, because and one of the things you bring up, and this is one of the things that's been in all your books, is always making the human connection to the natural phenomena. So much of our literature, when you're talking about turtle doves, mentions the turtle doves or refers to them, or in poetry, in Shakespeare. The list is endless. So these creatures of cuckoos is another one. They've always had cultural coinage for us. And now people are not going to understand what they were referring to. Of course, people don't read anyways now. I shouldn't say that's the problem is nobody reads anymore, too.
Well, it's getting a problem. People are getting more distanced from nature.
Yeah.
I mean, I've again, I've been sent some troubling figures lately about the what you might call nature illiteracy of children. This refers to Britain, but I'm sure you'd find comparable figures in America. One in four children now don't know what a robin is and don't know what a conker is. 8 in 10 children can't recognise an oak leaf. I mean, these are rather terrifying figures, and there's a move to counter this, of course. There's a lot of nature writers are trying to counter it, and in the UK, at any rate, there's a move, quite a powerful move, to establish a natural history examination at quite a low level.
Yeah. So
people start learning about this. When I went to primary school, my first school, you know, we had a nature table where we all brought in things we couldn't identify, acorns and leaves and feathers and bits of moss and so on. And, you know, a sympathetic teacher would use these to interest us in what these things were, how they worked, how they related to each other. What we now might call ecology. We didn't use that word, but it was just taking a lively, informed interest in the natural world.
Well, and it's like what's happening right around you. I used to take groups of sixth graders. I taught at the Worcester Art Museum. We would do art projects, and then I'd take them actually out on a small hike at the Quabbin Reservoir here. And I was surprised that sixth graders had never seen a frog before.
Yeah.
At one point, I was pointing out some coyote scat, and they all looked puzzled. And one of the students said, "You mean animals go to the bathroom outside?" And I went, "Where do you think that they were making toilets?" But it really hit home for me that they're not getting any kind of natural history, basic natural history. Okay, now. Again, with the political climate being what it was, a lot of people go, so what? You know, what's the problem? They have other things to do. And I think it's our job, and people like you who are doing it in books like this, is to teach people why this stuff is important.
Well, I do agree. One of the key faculties, one of the key human faculties, which I think we should encourage and nurture, is the faculty of wonder.
You talk about that,
which I talk about quite a bit. I mean, children do respond with wonder to the world. It's a combination of curiosity and awe and respect, and it feeds both the scientific imagination and the literary imagination. Wondering about the world is both asking questions about how it works and standing back and expressing, you know, one's extraordinary response and inspiration that's caused by the natural world in all its diversity and extraordinary beauty.
You talk about noticing, naming, and identifying are crucial, but the wonder is on that list too. And there are two meanings for wonder.
Yes, I make a distinction between wondering about something and wondering at something. It seems to me that wondering about something, which is a kind of elemental human reaction to the world, is a kind of curiosity that eventually leads into scientific thought. Wondering about the world, how it works, what this thing is, how it relates to other things. That's all factual wondering. But there's also wondering at the world, which is a more expressive attitude associated with art, literature, poetry, music, and so on. Responding to the world in a more intuitive and imaginative way. And I think both are important, and both can be integrated in this idea of wonder, I think.
Yeah, one of the things you write about in this epilogue, you talk about Jane Eyre and her spending time alone with Thomas Bewick's History of British Birds. I grew up that way. I grew up with a lot of natural history books in the house that I used to just sort of sit down on a rainy day or whenever and just look at and wonder at it. I would look at different scenes that were happening in other parts of the world other than where I lived. And it really developed this curiosity and a desire to go and visit those places and to see those things. But I love the fact that it was Thomas Bewick's History of British Birds. I finally own a copy of that, one of the original printings. I love that book. I love his woodcuts are just outstanding. We did an exhibition of his work decades back at the Worcester Art Museum here, and it was incredible to actually see one of the, I think it's the boxwood that he would carve. They actually had an example.
That's right.
Oh, my God. But the most important thing is to have that resource for your child in the house.
Yes.
A list of books.
That's exactly the way I actually start this book, by reflecting on my very own first bird book, and it produced those reactions in me. I've still got this thing. It's battered to death. but I took it with me everywhere, including in the garden and in the woods and so on. And, you know, I'd read the little articles and look at the pathetic illustrations and try and match them with what I was discovering. But it encouraged me just to explore, and to think for myself. And I think if one wants to make one Christmas wish, as it were, is that we should all give children a book about nature.
Yeah, I grew up with the Golden Guides, the little...
I've got your Golden Guide, yeah.
Yeah, and I had all of them for insects, for mammals, for reptiles and amphibians, and especially for birds. Mm-hmm. And they were amazing. Now, I had books before that about birds, too. But it's funny, I still have my original copies. I will not let those go. They have so many memories for me. There's so many touchstones of experiences that I associate with these books.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question, Mark? I pick on the turtle dove as my example of a bird which is saturated in our culture and which is fading fast. What would you think of as an equivalent North American bird?
Oh, that's really interesting.
Would it be a whooping crane or a condor or something?
Both of those cases are now completely supported by human intervention. And small populations both exist still. I would say a more common birds. I'm trying to think of things like, you know, bitterns. We have a lot of marshes here, birds and rails. It's what's bothering me is it's birds that I used to see a lot of are just like migratory waterfowl are all declining. I was just thinking about horned grebes here. 10, 15 years ago, I used to go to the local reservoir here and we'd have 15 maybe in a flock. Now it's tough to find one in a year in fall. The stuff just seems to be happening across the board. I was originally passionate about reptiles and I haven't seen a green snake. It used to be common when I was a kid. I haven't seen one in a couple of decades. Most people don't see snakes anymore, mainly because most people have a knee-jerk reaction to kill any snake as soon as they see it, even though it's totally harmless. Yeah. So we used to see snakes all the time. They were in our backyards. They're not there anymore. All that stuff is gone. I mean, it's just here. It's just sort of across the board stuff. That just bit by bit every year is whittling away.
What about the summer migrants? I mean, it seems to me that birds like the hirundines, the swallows and martins are particularly important in this because they're markers of seasons for people.
Yeah, that stuff.
Ordinary country people notice this now.
Well, the problem is a complicated series of causes that cause the swallows to decline. First of all, we've almost totally lost cliff swallow. It used to nest under barns. What happened is everybody got barns with no eaves and not the right kind of... one of the big ones, this just occurred to me, nighthawks. Now, when I grew up, a common nighthawk was a common summer bird around cities at dusk. And you'd see it under streetlights picking up large insects and stuff like that. When I was in college here in Worcester, we saw nighthawks move into the city at night, and you would hear their weird sort of call that sounds a little bit like a woodcock. When I did the, they were common, and they were a part of summer, like evenings, you would hear, and you'd hear their bull roarer sound that they would make when they did these dives to attract a mate. What has happened is about 10 years ago, we did a breeding bird survey across the state. It was the second one organized by Massachusetts Audubon, and I was in charge of the whole Worcester County, which is in the big county in the center of the state. We found no breeding nighthawks, zero.
Oh, dear.
Zero. And that was true for a lot of the places. And I was shocked. I really couldn't believe it. Now, they're still migrate in the fall from Canada, but the numbers are declining. But the nighthawk as a summer bird is just not here. It's in some very few locations around the state. But that was a common bird. That was a bird you knew about. You would listen to it, and you would see it like under these big streetlights catching these June bugs and stuff like that. It's not happening. Yep. And I don't even want to get started about insects, because that's all gone by the wayside too.
And that's why the nighthawks have gone.
Well, the nighthawks have gone for a couple of reasons. First of all, they used to love nesting on these flat roofs that had gravel on it. And then we had an explosion of corvids due to a whole bunch of other reasons, who then preyed on their young. People also don't make those roofs anymore. And then if they chose to nest on the ground, so many people have dogs and cats that are just running around, you know, decimating ground nesters. That's a big problem here. So, you know, it's like, it's amazing. And I go back over the places that I surveyed 10 years ago, and there's even less habitat and there are fewer birds.
Yeah. So, here, at any rate, it's the decline in the insect population that's led directly to the decline of a lot of these passerines and migrant birds.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, the good example, I think your nighthawk's an excellent example, because it does relate to people's common experience of years ago. The example here would be the cuckoo.
I can't imagine. That's such a big figure in literature. Like, I mean, every poet talks about the cuckoo.
Exactly. And it's still a strong folk memory. People stop me in the street still in our village about mid-April and say, "Jeremy, have you heard the cuckoo yet?" Well, the answer is no, we've lost the cuckoo. But they still ask me that question. You know, it's something that calibrates the season for them. And the swifts are going the same way. I'm afraid the swallow numbers are down. These are all migrant birds dependent on insect life. And the cuckoo, of course, is mainly a caterpillar eater, so that decline is caused by the equivalent decline in moth and butterfly species.
Well, in Britain, I think unlike America, part of the problem also is agricultural practices, because you no longer have those beautiful hedgerows that used to support so much wildlife.
That's exactly right.
Now, before we go, I want to talk about if people are skeptical that a major event could happen, as you write about in the second to the last chapter, Future Nature, the Earth has actually faced six mass extinction events before the Anthropocene.
That's right. We've been through five extinction events, and the Anthropocene seems likely to bring about the sixth. And on each occasion, a very high proportion of wildlife was destroyed. In the case of the Permian one, I think it's up to 93%.
Yeah, life just squeezed by there. I mean,
sliver was left.
And yeah, that was
eventually,
it.
Eventually, over the millions of years, it regenerated again. And, of course, that might happen again, but wow.
Well, you know, you quote a Peter, I think, Frankopan, who suggested that maybe nature will solve the climate crisis through catastrophic depopulation of humans.
Yes, that's what that was. He wrote a big history called The Earth Transformed that was published last year. He's an Oxford professor who also wrote a best-selling book about the Silk Roads. He does come to that conclusion right at the end of his book, that eventually there may be catastrophic depopulation through hunger, disease, and conflict, so reducing the human footprint on the Earth. And he is quite pessimistic that we will find our way through that.
And the problem is, as the planet gets hotter, and it definitely is getting hotter, there are problems of food production. There seem to be an awful lot of other challenges that are going to sort of rapidly cause a spiral in events. Like you write, as the world heats up, we're going to need more air conditioning. And more, that means more energy use, and that means exasperating the problem. It's just amazing that people aren't looking at this in long term and trying to put the brakes on now before we really get into trouble. By the time we're
and it would also also being increasing urbanization, I'm sure, which will have an effect.
You're talking about air conditioning. Yeah, I think, but urbanization could be good if it was done correctly. Then it would leave more habitat to be able to regenerate. That's what I'd like to see. Like this, I'd like to see sane urban development and design, and then leave a lot more land to be open and for hopefully the biodiversity to regenerate. But I know that's not going to happen. That's just too. It's like one of those ideas that when you get to that political wall, it just is it never gives in. Anything that's going to cause anybody a little bit of inconvenience now is resisted tremendously.
Yeah. And one has to say that the current political scene is not encouraging in that respect.
No, no, it's not. And not in anywhere. It's like when you talk about especially the Northern Hemisphere, there's quite a number of bad players that are the heads of countries. And it's they're not going to address this issue at all. We got to somehow, Jeremy, we only have a few minutes left. We have to somehow try to end on a more upbeat note. Can we do that?
Well, the upbeat thing is that through this book, and I must say through some of the other books I've written, I've tried to give examples of the way that humans can find significance and inspiration in nature.
Yeah.
That is our best hope, I think. Nature is an extraordinary source of delight, joy, and wonder, and I hold to that myself.
Me too. You're listening to WICN. My returning guest tonight is writer and researcher Jeremy Minot. He's an emeritus fellow at Wolfson College, Cambridge, and was formerly chief executive of Cambridge University Press. And we've been continuing our conversation about his new book, The Story of Nature, A Human History. It's a must read. Jeremy, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me on again.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.